Good morning. If you will take your Bibles and turn to Daniel chapter 1. Daniel chapter 1.
It's good to be with you at least for these next 3 days, I guess. Today, tomorrow, and Tuesday. And I'm looking forward to our time together. I was here, several years ago now. And you look like you've changed a little bit. And that is okay. That's what churches are supposed to do. They're supposed to change, and they're supposed to grow, and younger people are supposed to get older, and they're supposed to be more younger people, and it looks like that is the case. And so it's good to be with you, and good to be here with you for this time together this week. I hope our time together is profitable. One of the things that I like to do is I like to take a section of Scripture, maybe from a time period in the Bible, and I like to talk about that time period. And so that's what we're going to do with our time together over these next five lessons that we have, is we're going to talk about the captivity and the return from captivity. And I hope there's a lot of things that we'll learn from that, things that we can take with us even today that apply to our lives today. And so let's look at Daniel chapter 1. Look with me in verse 1. It says, in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. The Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the vessels of the house of God, and he brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and he brought the vessels into the treasury of his God. Then the king ordered Aspenaz, the chief of his officials, to bring in some of the sons of Israel, including some of the royal family and of the nobles, youths in whom was no defect, who were good-looking, showing intelligence in every branch of wisdom, endowed with understanding and discerning knowledge, and who had ability for serving in the king's court. And he ordered him to teach them the literature and language of the Chaldeans. The king appointed for them a daily ration from the king's choice food and from the wine which he drank, and appointed that they should be educated 3 years, at the end of which they were to enter the king's personal service. Now among them, from the sons of Judah, were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Then the commander of the officials assigned new names to them, and to Daniel he assigned the name Belteshazzar, to Hananiah Shadrach, to Mishael, Meshach, and to Azariah, Abednego. Not long after the children of Israel had left Egypt and were led out of Egypt by Moses, God warned them. Back in Deuteronomy 28, you can read about it. God told them that if you trust me, if you put your faith in me, if you serve me, if you worship me, if you keep my commandments, then I will be your God. You will be my people. You will prosper. You will do well. It was a very positive promise. But with that positive promise also came a very negative promise. He said, if you do not serve me, if you do not put your faith in me, if you do not trust in me, if you do not obey me, then I am going to raise up captors. You will be taken captive. And as a result of that captivity, you're not going to do very well. You're going to live in the land with all of these foreign people, and you're really not going to know very much of anything about who you are because you have left me. You have abandoned me. You will not do well. And after the kingdom divided, the northern kingdom of Israel fell away almost completely from the Lord. There was a remnant of faithful people there. But for the most part, they fell away completely from the Lord. The Assyrians conquered Israel in 722 BC. They held them captive. And then Judah and its capital, Jerusalem, the southern kingdom, they had some bad kings. They had some good kings after that. Josiah was the last good king that they had. But eventually they would be taken captive somewhere around 605 BC when the Babylonians dominated the Assyrians at the Battle of Carchemish. And it was at this time when Nebuchadnezzar returned to Babylon with several hostages from among the Jewish people. And it was at this time when Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah were among those who had been almost or absolutely completely uprooted from their families and their homes and their homeland. And they were taken captive into Babylon. And please understand one thing about that. for these boys, that was a life-changing, life-altering moment for them. Their lives were turned completely upside down. Let me ask you this. When you think about the story of Daniel and his friends, what do we normally think about? If you're like me, you think about Daniel and the lion's den and how Daniel stuck to his guns and Daniel was thrown into the den of lions and there was no harm that was done to him. You might think about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, or when I was a kid, I would call it a billy goat. And when I would come out of Bible class and my parents would ask me, Wiley, what did you talk about in Bible class? I would say, we talked about a billy goat, you know, Shadrach, Meshach, and a billy goat. But at the end of the day, you might think about that story and that fiery furnace and how no harm was done to them because they stood up. They took a stand for what was right and against what was wrong. For others, it might be that Daniel and his friends lived on vegetables for 3 years. And so as a parent, you might use that to tell your children to eat their vegetables because they are good for them. And so that might be what you think about. But I want you to know, I want you to think about something different. I want you to think about for just a moment, what was life like for these men in Babylon? What was it like living in Babylon? You know, I think for most of us, it is very hard to contemplate what it must have been like to be in a society that was an agrarian society. Even if you're from Charlotte or from one of these small communities around Clarksville or Dixon or somewhere around this side of Nashville, it's still hard for us today to fully grasp what it's like to live in an agrarian style of living or an agrarian society. A society that did not have the technology that we have today. A society that did not give warnings when armies would come and take countries captive. And not only were they living in a culture like that, they were not just taken captive in place. It's not like Babylon just came and occupied Israel and Judah. That's not what happened at all. They came, they conquered, and then they took hostages and they brought them back to Babylon. These boys were brought back to serve Babylon. And so what was life in Babylon like for these young men? And how does this apply to us today? Well, first of all, let's talk about what life was like in Babylon for these young men. And the first thing that we want to point out is that they were constantly being influenced by their new culture. Nebuchadnezzar was leading the dominant world empire of the day. And as you can imagine, there was a certain amount of pomp and egoism and pride that were associated with that. And Nebuchadnezzar was full of that pomp and egoism and pride. His servants were full of that pride as well. He was a conqueror. He wanted to have his own way. And so while in Judah, Nebuchadnezzar saw that there were these young men who could help him in his cause. Look back at Daniel 1. Look at verse 3 and verse 4. The king ordered Aspenaz, the chief of his officials, to bring in some of the sons of Israel, including some of the royal family and of the nobles, youths in whom was no defect, who were good-looking, showing intelligence in every branch of wisdom, endowed with understanding and discerning knowledge, and who had ability for serving in the king's court. Just think about that for just a moment. It tells us they were youths in whom there was no defect. They were good-looking. Nothing wrong with being good-looking, right? Nothing wrong with that. But they were good-looking men. They had intelligence. They had wisdom. They were endowed with understanding and discernment. And they had the ability to serve in the king's court. So among these men were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. If you will notice, I always like to refer to them by their Hebrew names. I'll tell you why in just a moment. But these young men were given the opportunity to be immersed, and I use that word opportunity loosely, to be immersed in the teaching of the literature and the language of the Chaldeans for 3 years. We're going to talk about Babylonian history with them. We're going to talk about the Babylonian language with them. In fact, they're not going to just hear about it. They're going to be fluent in these things. And so they were. And after 3 years, they would be appointed to the king's personal service. And as a part of all of that, they would be treated essentially like Babylonian royals. They would be given special food to drink, or special food to eat and things to drink, the king's choice food and wine. And you have to understand that for men leaving home and going into this new big capital city, with this new lifestyle, that might be appealing for them. But you see, Nebuchadnezzar had a goal in mind, and his goal was to acclimate them to the best of his ability to Babylon. I want you to think about what that would be like for these men. Nebuchadnezzar's goal was to get them to believe that, hey, Babylon is not that bad. That Babylon is not my homeland. Babylon's not where my family is from. Babylon is not where my family is, probably. But at the end of the day, you know, this place is really not so bad. I didn't get treated like this at home. I didn't get to eat like this at home. I didn't get to do the things that I get to do here at home. I didn't have any of these things. I didn't get this kind of treatment at home. It would be similar to a country boy today graduating high school, getting a full ride to some college somewhere, going to that college in some big city, and then, of course, they don't ever come back home. Why? Because they're enamored with what they are doing with their degree and where they're living, and they are happy with that, and they don't come back home. I mean, how many times do our kids leave us when they go to college and they don't come back? It happens all the time, especially in places like Clarksville, I would imagine, right? And why does that happen? It happens because we want to live our lives. Well, these young men were introduced to a totally new way of living, and for them, I could easily see them being tempted to say, hey, this treatment is not that bad. Eventually, you forget your roots altogether, and you begin to enjoy the new life. Probably a little bit too much. And you forget who you are. But not only were these young men treated like royals, notice verse 7 again. It says, then the commander of the officials assigned new names to them. And to Daniel, he assigned the name Belteshazzar, and to Hananiah, Shadrach, to Mishael, Meshach, and to Azariah, Abednego. They were given new names. And if you're reading this, you might be tempted to think, well, that's not that big of a deal. Who cares about that? But I want to suggest to you that this was a huge deal. It was an enormous deal. In fact, I think that's exactly why the Holy Spirit put this in this text for us, to understand just how big of a deal this was. Daniel's Hebrew name was Daniel, which in the Hebrew language means God is my judge. It was a name to remind him whom he served, that he served God. But Aspenaz gave him the name Belteshazzar, which means a servant of Baal, or protect the life of Baal. Hananiah's name in the Hebrew language means Yahweh, or the Lord is gracious. And his name was changed to the Babylonian name of Shadrach, which means the command of Aku, or inspired by the sun god. Do you see what's happening here? Mishael's name in the Hebrew language was who is what God is, but his name was changed to the Babylonian name of Meshach, which means who is what Aku is, the sun god is. Azariah's name in the Hebrew language means Yahweh has helped, but his name was changed to the Babylonian name of Abednego, which means servant of Nebo. Here's the point. Nebuchadnezzar was not just trying to change these young men's language or their educational understanding or their lifestyle. Nebuchadnezzar wanted to change their faith too. And at every turn, they were constantly being indoctrinated into the culture of the day. He was trying to change their faith. He was trying to change their lifestyle. He was trying to change their identity. Now, don't we hear a lot today about identity and how we identify? Are you starting to see some things about how the story of Daniel might relate to us today in our culture just a little bit? But number two, I want to point out that they were often persecuted for their faith. We don't have time to read the whole story of Daniel. I wish we did. But in chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar has a dream about the kingdoms of the earth. And when Daniel finally interprets this dream for Nebuchadnezzar, he learns that Babylon is not going to dominate the world forever. Now, can you imagine being Nebuchadnezzar, this pompous, arrogant king of a dominant world force, and some Hebrew comes and tells you, you're not going to dominate the world forever. That's the interpretation of the dream. I think that would be almost a little insulting for Nebuchadnezzar. He would not like that very much. And so in chapter 3, Nebuchadnezzar builds a huge gold image. Now, what's significant about that? What's significant about that is that in chapter 2, the head in that statue was a head of gold, and that was representative, or that represented Babylon. And then these other parts of this statue were represented by other materials, and those would represent other kingdoms, the Greek Empire, the Medo-Persian Empire, and so forth, right? And so Nebuchadnezzar decides, you know what? That head of gold is not good enough. I want to, and this is what I think is happening in the story, I want to build a whole statue of gold. And so Nebuchadnezzar builds in chapter 3 this whole statue of gold. And what is, and again, what is significant about that is that in chapter 2, the statue that of the dream that he had, only the head was of gold. He wants everybody to worship this statue that he builds in chapter 3. Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah, known as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego say, no, we are not going to bow down to your statue. And so Nebuchadnezzar threw them into the fiery furnace, and God was with them, and no harm was done to them. But please make no mistake about it, that was a great persecution. They were constantly being persecuted for their faith. Are you starting to see how this might apply to us in our culture today? Are you starting to connect some dots here? Let's move on. Number three, they were often the target of envy and jealousy. Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah were all given prominent roles in the government. Because of their faith and their uncompromising character, God gave them success. And all too often, we're tempted to think, oh, well, this is great. You know, this is the story, right? We can survive in an ungodly world, and yes, we can. And that is a moral, one of the morals of this story. Absolutely. I completely agree with that. But think about what life was like for them in this ungodly world. Think about their uncompromising character in this ungodly world. Because of their success, they were often targeted. In Daniel chapter 6, under the rule of Darius, Daniel was placed in charge of everybody. And the other leaders, they did not like that very much. And so they tricked Darius into making a decree, knowing that Daniel would not stop praying to God. Now, can you imagine that? How did they get Daniel in trouble? By tricking the guy in charge to make a decree because they knew Daniel would not stop praying to his God. They knew Daniel was very faithful. And so ultimately Daniel was thrown into this lion's den and God was with him. And again, no harm was done to him. But that happened because of envy. That happened because of jealousy. and that happened because of anger and wrath associated with that envy and jealousy. All of those words are often used together in the New Testament. There's anger, there's wrath, there's envy, there's jealousy. They all work hand in hand together. And here's the point that I want us to understand. Life was not easy for these men. I think we look at this story sometime and we think to ourselves, look how rewarding it is to be faithful to God, and look at how they prospered, and look at how it all ended up in the end. Listen, life was never easy for them. Life was not a walk in the park at all for these men. These men did have a lot of success, but ladies and gentlemen, they also faced a lot of persecution and evil and difficulty. Living in Babylon was not very easy for them. And so what can we take from their experiences? Number one, we need to understand that we are living in Babylon today. You know, there are a lot of people who love the United States of America, and I love the United States of America too. Great country. Love living here. I travel all over the world to go and preach. I've been to several different countries, and I will tell you, when my feet land in the USA, there is a sigh of relief sometimes because I'm back home. I love this country. But can I tell you that this country is not God's chosen country? We need to understand that. That this is not like what we read about in the Old Testament, where Israel was God's chosen nation. The church is God's chosen nation today, in a sense. The church is spiritual Israel, and we need to understand that. It's not the United States of America. In all reality, we're living in Babylon, if you think about it. We are living in an evil and a wicked and a twisted and a backward and an upside down world. And by the way, I realize that might sound really negative, and I hate that because I'm a really positive person. I'm a glass half full kind of guy personally. But at the end of the day, reality is reality. We live in a wicked world. Take your Bibles and turn over to the New Testament to 1 John chapter 2. 1 John chapter 2. And I want you to notice just a few verses with me here. 1 John 2 and look at verse 15. 1 John 2 and verse 15. Do not love the world, nor the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh and the lust of the eyes and the boastful pride of life, is not from the Father, but is from the world. The world is passing away and also its lust, but the one who does the will of God lives forever. John tells us that all that is in the world is lust and pride, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the boastful pride of life. That is our world today. And this world is not our home. Take your Bibles and turn back to James chapter 4. James chapter 4, and notice what's said there in verse 4. James chapter 4 and verse 4. James says, "You adulteresses, do you not know that friendship with the world is hostility toward God? Therefore, whoever wishes to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God." I want you to think about the language that James uses here. James is writing to Christians. He's writing to disciples of Jesus Christ, just like you and me. And these people were quarreling, they were bickering, they were fighting, and James calls them out because of all of these things for loving this world. And I want you to think about the word that he uses to describe these Christians in this moment. Notice what he says in verse 4. He calls them adulteresses. Think about that for just a second. James compares these people and what they are doing to the act of adultery. I don't think I have to go into detail about what adultery is here, although I might, because there are some in the among brethren that don't understand the meaning of that word very well. But at the end of the day, we all know what it's like on some level to be cheated, right? And if you ever know somebody who has gotten a divorce because they have been cheated on by their spouse, then you understand what adultery is, right? It's a very graphic term if you think about it. It paints a picture in all of our minds. We know what adultery is. We understand that. And when God uses a term to describe what it's like when His people love this world more than they love Him, what's the term that He uses? He uses adultery. We're cheating on God. Now just think about that for just a moment. That's the same imagery that's used throughout the Bible, especially in the Old Testament. In Numbers 25, the sons of Israel played the harlot with the daughters of Moab. And yes, I believe that is indicative of the fact that some of the Israelites were fornicating, but the focus of that text is not near as much on fornication as it is on the fact that they had turned to the gods of the Moabites. They were cheating on God. They had cheated on God with Moabite idols. This imagery is used all throughout the prophets. Do you remember Hosea? Hosea is told to go and to marry a harlot, a prostitute, Gomer. And so he goes and he marries Gomer. In chapter 3 of Hosea, he is told to love a woman who has cheated on her husband, who is an adulteress. And the whole point of that and the whole point of Hosea is to illustrate that God's chosen people had left God for other gods. And when they had done that, they had cheated. They had gone into spiritual harlotry. They had gone into spiritual prostitution. They had gone into spiritual adultery. That's the imagery that God paints for us in His book. And ladies and gentlemen, that is the world that we live in. It is a wicked world. And in this wicked world, we need to understand that wicked people are going to do wicked things. And sometimes we are surprised by that. Sometimes we are caught off guard by that. Sometimes we act just completely shocked and dumbfounded when an evil person does something that is evil. Let me illustrate that for you. I love whales. I love SeaWorld. Back when I got married, me and my wife, we went to San Diego and we went to SeaWorld. That was my first time to ever go to SeaWorld. And I'm telling you, that was one of the greatest things that ever happened to me because I love the whales. I love the Shamu show. I love the Celine Dion music where they get the whale to go up and you know, near, far, wherever you are, all of that stuff. And don't get me started on the beluga whales. I'll start crying. I love the whales. I'm with Scott and Lori this week, and last night, what did we talk about? Their deep sea diving that they like to do, and I talked about, hey, I would love to go to New Zealand to see the beluga whales. I'd love to do that. There's so many things I would do. I love whales. I love the ocean. I love anything water. That is me. Well, a few years ago, you'll remember, there was all this talk about SeaWorld and the treatment of the whales, and especially the mother whales and the baby whales. I don't want to get into that. But what was interesting to me about that is some of the same people who were so up in arms about that were the same people who would advocate for a young lady to be able to go to an abortion clinic and to end the life of her unborn child in abortion. Guys, I don't know about y'all, but that's just upside down to me. It's backwards. It is wicked. It is evil. It is not right. And yet sometimes we act surprised by that, that people can't see their own hypocrisy. Wicked people are going to do wicked things. God even warns us that wicked people are going to do wicked things. Go over to 1 Peter chapter 2 and look at verse 12. 1 Peter chapter 2 and look at verse 12. 1 Peter 2 and verse 12. Peter says this. He says, keep your behavior excellent among the Gentiles, so that in the thing in which they slander you as evildoers, they may, because of your good deeds, as they observe them, glorify God in the day of visitation. So any time in the New Testament you see the word Gentiles, a lot of the times when you see the word Gentiles in the New Testament, you can also translate that word world, okay? And so notice what it says. Keep your behavior excellent among the world, if you change that there for that, so that in the thing in which they slander you as evildoers, they may, because of your good deeds, as they observe them, glorify God in the day of visitation. And so evil people are going to do evil things, and they're going to accuse righteous people of being evil, right? That's what they're going to do. So go over to 1 Peter chapter 4 and look at verse 12 and verse 13. 1 Peter 4 and verse 12 and verse 13, Peter goes on to say this. He says, "Beloved, do not be surprised at the fiery ordeal among you, which comes upon you for your testing, as though some strange thing were happening to you. But to the degree that you share the suffering of Christ, keep on rejoicing, so that also at the revelation of His glory you may rejoice with exultation." They're facing persecution, and he's saying, hey, do not be surprised by this. Why? Because evil people are going to do evil things. And we need to understand that. Evil people are going to do evil things. How do they do that? Well, let me illustrate that for you. Turn over to the Proverbs. And let's go back to Proverbs chapter 17. Proverbs chapter 17. And let's just walk through some Proverbs together and notice some things that the Proverbs say about the world and what happens with the evil and with those who are upright. Proverbs 17, look at verse 15 with me. Proverbs 17, verse 15. Notice what it says. "He who justifies the wicked and he who condemns the righteous, both of them alike are an abomination to the Lord." Think about that. We're justifying the wicked. We're condemning the righteous. Does that happen today? Do people justify the wicked and condemn the righteous? Does that not happen in our world today? Absolutely it does. Hey, go to Proverbs 18. Look at Proverbs 18. Look at verse 5. Notice this one. "To show partiality to the wicked is not good, nor to thrust aside the righteous in judgment." Do people show partiality to the wicked, and do they take the righteous and they just thrust us aside and they don't want to have anything to do with us? Absolutely they do. Think about that for just a second. They do it all the time. And we need to understand that this is the kind of world that we live in. This is what is happening in our world today. Go over to Proverbs 24. Proverbs 24, and look with me at verse 23. Proverbs 24 and verse 23. "These are also sayings of the wise. To show partiality in judgment is not good. He who says to the wicked, 'You are righteous,' people will curse him, nations will abhor him. But to those who rebuke the wicked will be delight, and a good blessing will come upon them." And so there's this idea of wisdom that when we rebuke the wicked, we're actually doing what's right. But the world is not going to like that very much. It was mentioned in the Proverbs. It happens today. It happened in Isaiah's day. Turn over to Isaiah chapter 5 and just a few pages over from Proverbs. Isaiah chapter 5, and notice what's said there in verse 20. Isaiah 5, verse 20. "Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who substitute darkness for light and light for darkness, who substitute bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. Woe to those who are wise in their own eyes and clever in their own sight. Woe to those who are heroes in drinking wine and valiant men in mixing strong drink, who justify the wicked for a bribe and take away the rights of the ones who are in the right." Can I ask you a question? Does that not remind you of our government structure today in the best nation in the world? Who justify the wicked for a bribe and take away the rights of the ones who are in the right. Is that not what we're living in today? Don't tell me that America is God's chosen nation. The church is God's chosen people. We need to understand that. We need to understand that we are living in Babylon, where evil people are going to do evil things. And listen, sometimes we complain that things just continue to go from bad to worse. It reminds me of what Paul said to Timothy in 2 Timothy 3 and verse 13. "Evil men and imposters will proceed from bad to worse, deceiving and being deceived." Don't be surprised. Can I ask you this question? Why would anybody fall in love with this world? Here's why I ask that. It's because the temptation for so many of us is to have one foot in the world and one foot in the church. We want to be good church-going people, right? And we want the world to see us being good church-going people. And so here's what we do. We have one foot in the church, and we have one foot planted in the world. We want to be in the church. We want to be in Christ. We want to do the right thing. We want to serve Him. We want to be moral. But then we're out in the world, and there's temptation, and there's all sorts of things going on around us. And so we get to, in our minds that, okay, well, I'm going to be a Christian, and I'm going to worship, and I'm going to do all these things, but, you know, in my daily life, I'm going to do these other things, right? I'm going to dress immodestly. I'm going to go and drink it up after work with my friends at work. I'm going to go and I'm going to, you know, do whatever it is I want to do. I'm going to forsake the assembly of the saints. I'm not going to try to worship when I'm on vacation, because after all, I'm on vacation. I'm on vacation from the Lord too, right? So I don't have to do that. So I'm going to do all of these things that define being in the world, and I'm going to have a foot in the world. So before long, what happens is the world starts to pull on us, and then some preacher comes and holds a meeting in the church, and he's starting to pull on me too. And so before long, the world's pulling on me like this. Yeah, it's fixing to happen. And then the preacher's pulling on me like this, and then guess what's happening? I'm doing the spiritual splits. Get that vision in your mind. And before long, one person is going to be pulled out of the church and into the world, because the world is always going to be pulling hard. And if the church is not doing their job and pulling back, then guess what's going to happen? You're going to lose that person. They're going to go into the world. Can I tell you what my advice to you as a church is? Don't let go. If it pulls their legs off, don't let go. You are a family of God's people. Don't let go of each other. Because families don't let go. We need to understand what is happening in our lives today and in our world. We don't belong here. This world is not our home. This country is not our home. The state of Tennessee is not your home. If you don't fit here, then guess what? If you do fit here, then guess what? You're not going to fit up there. You're not going to fit in heaven. Heaven is not for you if you fit on this earth. And I realize that's difficult to hear. We're living in Babylon. And we need to understand that. Now, I guess I have 5 minutes left, right? Let me say this. How do we get through this world? Character and courage and consistency. In Daniel chapter 1, Daniel and his friends did not defile themselves with the king's choice food. In Daniel chapter 3, in the face of death, they said, "Even if we die, we are not going to bow down to your God, King Nebuchadnezzar." Daniel had surrounded himself with good friends. Friends that would take a stand just like he took a stand. In Daniel chapter 6, how did the other leaders trap Daniel in the first place? They knew that he would not compromise his faith in God. Why? Because of Daniel's character, because of Daniel's consistency, and because of Daniel's courage. They knew that. Paul Earnhardt once told me, "Wiley, our biggest problem in the church is that we baptized a lot of people, but we have not made disciples." I think that's true. Disciples have character, the character of Christ. They are consistent. And they have the consistency of Christ, and they have the courage of Christ. And I want to leave you with one thought. When I talk about the fact that we're living in Babylon, I want you to understand what I see happening in the church and in the world today. We need to teach our children, and we need to teach ourselves to live in a world with positivity and character and consistency and courage, instead of teaching everyone to be afraid of this world. Here's what I mean by that. God never told his people to go out of the world. In fact, he discouraged that. He gives us the tools to live a righteous life, a positive life, in this world. If you go watch Fox News right now, what are you going to get? Negativity, right? That's most Christians watch Fox News. So, you know, that's kind of where it is. Negativity. If you watch any news station, what are you going to get? You're going to get a lot of negativity. And that negativity is going to drag you down. And you're going to complain, and you're going to start using this language about being scared to live in this world. Courage is not necessarily the absence of fear, but it's doing the right thing in the face of fear. And what I want us to understand is we need to be teaching ourselves and our children to have courage in this world, and to live with consistency in this world, and to have character in this world, more so than we're teaching them to be afraid of this world. I want my kids to grow up learning to do what is right and do what is right always. And I want them to be able to do that with a smile on their face as best they possibly can. Because I got to tell you, Christians have become so pessimistic over the state of affairs in our world that we've stopped being lights in the world. And we need to show people a better way. And so let's show people the character and the consistency and the courage that it takes to live on this earth, to live in Babylon. And let's have that same character, consistency, and courage that Daniel and his friends had as we live in captivity. Because make no mistake about it, we are captives. This world is not our home. We're just passing through. Thank you for listening this morning.